Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome. And I want to give really a special welcome to Rabbi Dr. David Harbater, who's speaking for the first time in Torah Moshe. I asked him to speak. He was going to be in America. He lives in Israel, as you heard in Efrat. And he was planning to be in America this week. But of course, unfortunately, those plans were put on hold. So it's now 3:30 in the morning. So we want to give him a special extra yasher koach. And as we heard, he has a son in the army at Gaza and in the south waiting. So let's hope for good news for everybody. And should be, what can we say? We're all davening for, awful situation. Rabbi Dr. Harbater, this is his new book, In the Beginning, that is just recently published on the first 11 chapters, I believe. A Bereshit, of course, that's before we get to Abraham. He teaches at Midrash Torah Vavoda, at Amudim in Israel, at the Women's Beit Midrash in Efrat, has a PhD from University of Haifa, attended Yeshiva University, Yeshiva Har Etzion, and it's a pleasure to welcome here to learn Torah, Mamish, in the middle of the night, and we're here at the beginning of the evening. So Rabbi Harbater, it's all yours. Vakasha.
Thank you very much, Jay, Rabbi Jay. Yes, as Jay mentioned, I was meant to be in New York and giving the shiur at 8:30 in the evening, along with you at the same time. Unfortunately, I was meant to be on a book tour because, as Jay mentioned, my new book, In the Beginnings, was just released. And I had a whole series of events, Shabbat, Preshit, Shabbat Noach, had a whole series of events, including being in Montreal and a lot of other things that were scheduled, and everything was canceled virtually last minute because of the circumstances. As Jay mentioned, I have a son who's in the army. He's in the Sayeret Givati, the Givati Brigade, Givati Brigade. And he's on waiting to be called into Gaza at any point. So there's a tension in the air. But we're just hoping that the coming weeks will be better than the previous weeks, because can't be much worse, to be honest. As you probably know, Shabbat Simchat Torah was the worst day in the history of this country.
Heidi.
What? I'm sorry.
I did something here and it got.
I think you probably have to be put on mute. So it's interesting to say, I'm just mentioning this, that I was in shul in Efrat, which is where I'm giving this class from my home in Efrat. And a couple weeks ago, I was in Efrat for Shabbat Simchat Torah. And it became clear already by 8:00 in the morning that something was going on. And within an hour plus of being in shul in synagogue, that the buzz was going on in the shul, and people who had, you know, were listening to the radio or heard, you know, news of the events in the south were already talking, and it was clear that something dramatic.
Interrupting. Where is Efrat?
Oh, I'm sorry. Efrat is just south of Jerusalem. It's next to Beit Lechem. It's in the Gush Etzion area, the Gush Etzion block, and about 25 minutes south of Jerusalem. And anyway, so the news started to break, and, you know, tension in the air. We heard sirens. We had to go down to safe rooms. And just a little piece of information, a tidbit about me. My family made Aliyah when I was young, right before the Yom Kippur War. And so immediately I had associations, having been in Israel during the Yom Kippur War. And suddenly on Simchat Torah, we had a very similar feeling. And people could ask me, so how do you compare? And initially I thought, well, you know, we can't compare. Yom Kippur was really one of the greatest horrors of this country. And as events began to unfold in the days ahead, it became clear that this was actually worse than the Yom Kippur War. In terms of the number of deaths, casualties, civilian casualties, the way people were not killed but butchered and murdered, and you all know the horrible details. I don't want to go into it. And so we have been living very difficult times here, and we just have to hope and pray that, like I said, things will get better in the weeks to come. Let's learn some Torah. That's what we're here for. And actually, I chose a topic that I think has some relevance today, and you'll hopefully see why soon enough. I just have to mention that this week, if you could see this in the Jerusalem Report, some of you may subscribe to the Jerusalem Report. And on page 40 of the current issue of the Jerusalem Report is a review of my book. And it's extremely favorable. So I'm obviously very, very pleased. I have to temper my excitement because of what's going on, but it's kind of hard to contain myself. Okay. Let us begin. Now, Parshat Noach, you know, what comes to mind as soon as you mention this Parsha of Noach is the story of the flood, because that takes up the bulk of the Parsha. And there's a lot to say about it. And in my book, I have three chapters on it. And, however, I don't want to talk about the flood. And they say, what else is there to talk about? Well, the end of the Parsha also has a dramatic story, the Tower of Babel, right? Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babel. Again, even the title of the story is problematic, but it's, as you know what I'm talking about, for many of you who studied the Bible before, it's a short but succinct story that has a lot of, there's a lot of material there to be analyzed and studied. And that would be the end of the Parsha. And so people who are talking about this week's Parsha typically will focus on one theme or the other. But I am choosing to focus on something else, and it's usually an event that's glossed over and never quite understood why. It has to do with what happens with Noah or Noah or Noah right after the flood. And so I'm going to read the text with you. I hope that Jay mentioned or sent you an email asking that you come equipped with a text. I'll read the text. But if you have it with you, it'd probably be much easier to follow the shiur, the class. And it really begins in chapter 9 of Bereishit, chapter 9. And it's a short episode at the end of chapter 9. So I'm going to read the main section of the text. So now Noah, he exits the ark. Verse 18, chapter 9, verse 18. Vayuvenei Noach hayutzi min ha-teva shem v'cham v'yafet v'chamu aviknan. So now it talks about who are the people who left Noach and his children left the ark. Okay. Shlosha eda b'nei Noach u'me'eda nafza kol ha'aretz. These three were the sons of Noach, and from these the whole world branched out. Now here's where the story gets interesting, and it's very short. Vayachal Noach isha adama vayita karen. Noah, the tiller of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. I'm reading the JPS translation. Vayesht min ha'yayin vayishkal. He drank of the wine and became drunk, and he uncovered himself within his tent. Cham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Yafet took a cloth, placed it against both their backs, and walking backward, they covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way, so they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah woke up from his wine, he learned what his youngest son had done to him, and said, cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves shall be he be to his brothers. And then he said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, let Canaan be a slave to them. May God enlarge Yefet and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be a slave to them. End of story. So let's just summarize what we just read. Noah comes out of the ark. What does he do? The text describes him as a tiller of the soil. He was the first to plant a vineyard. He drank of the wine, became drunk. He became drunk. And as a result of the drunkenness, there's some indecent exposure, which is followed by a very, very, inappropriate, disrespectful response of his son, Cham. Who saw his nakedness, told his brothers, and then Shem and Yafet, out of respect for their father, they went ahead and they covered him, walking backwards, And at the end, when Noah wakes up from his drunkenness, he curses Ham, well, he curses Ham's son, Canaan, and then blesses Shem and Yeph. More or less the story. Now, when you look at the commentaries, both medieval and even to some extent modern commentaries, they typically focus on two aspects of the story. One is the fact that, well, one is what exactly did Ham do? Is it just that he saw, or did he actually do something in addition to seeing his father's nakedness? And the rabbis themselves debated whether he saw him and therefore engaged in some kind of sexual relations with his father, or he castrated him. These are suggestions made by already the rabbis. Or was it merely the very fact that he talked about in a very disrespectful way, a mocking way, to his brothers about his father's nakedness? Okay, so usually the debate among the scholars and the commentaries is, what exactly is the nature of Ham's impropriety? The second question that often is raised, and I sort of alluded to it here, is that if you read the text, right, who's the perpetrator? Well, it seems to be Ham, but who gets cursed? Ham's son, Canaan. So if Ham is the perpetrator, why is his son the one who's punished with the curse? Okay, so these are the questions that are typically discussed among the commentaries, and these are the questions I am not going to discuss. I'm going to discuss what I believe is far more perplexing and potentially interesting, because it has the potential to reveal something about the psychological state of Noah after the flood. And so really what I want to focus on is a few words, almost like a two psukim, two verses, right? The very fact that Noah, the tiller of the soil, verse 20, Noah, the tiller of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard, to drink the wine and get drunk and then uncover himself, and all the negative consequences of that. So what I want to understand is how do we make sense? Let's just talk about the fact of his drunkenness, right? Noach, this great tzaddik, right, gets off the boat after an extended period of time where he was and his family were on this ark, watched the flood unfold, and then leave this ark and plant and then get drunk. It doesn't seem to fit the character of Noah. We typically think, you know, we don't look very fondly upon drunkenness, except for Purim. The holiday of Purim is when we're encouraged to drink to a certain extent. Some people even say they drink and get drunk on Purim. But certainly that's not the kind of behavior we expect from this great tzaddik, this great righteous person, Noah, who's described explicitly by the text as being a righteous person. Right? We don't associate tzaddikim with people who get drunk. And so for some reason, commentaries sort of skip this, you know, gloss over it. And to me, I think this begs commentary. It begs commentary. And so we're going to try to make sense of this episode. And okay, so let's begin and try to make sense of what are his motives in the kind of behavior, his actions after the flood, and how do we assess them? So that's what we're going to try to focus on today. Okay, so let us begin. Let's try to imagine. Before we get to Noah, let's talk about what happened in Israel just a couple weeks ago. And again, you heard about it a couple days after it happened. For those of you who are keeping the Chag in outside of Israel, it's 2 days here. By the time you woke up from your Chag, it was already, Monday morning, Sunday night, which was Monday morning here. And we had already experienced a range of emotions after this horrible, vicious, brutal, and there are no words to describe, grotesque attack. So if you think about what emotions we were going through and have been going through since, right? This is not an event that you can simply turn the other way. This affects every single one of us. Most of us, in fact, all of us on some level personally, everyone knows somebody who was affected by this. Everyone in this country, has been to a funeral that's related to this event, this horror. And the question is, what kind of reaction, you know, what kind of reactions, how are emotions affected by this, these horrors? So think about it. It's a mix of emotions, right? First of all, it's the absolute shock, disbelief at what happened, because this great, you know, Israeli army which has always been considered one of the top in the world, was nowhere to be found. I'm going to confess that I turned on the television when I came home from shul. We went home very quickly and had a very short tefillah, very short davening prayer on Shabbat on that morning. And I turned on the television. I felt it was important that be attuned to what's going on, in case there's an emergency here already in the neighborhood. And I'm hearing it's surreal. It's you can't even imagine what it's like to live on television. You're hearing people calling from their safe rooms. They're on the phone whispering live to the news broadcasters that they are alone. They're talking because they have no one else to reach. The army is nowhere to be found. And they're talking to the broadcasters. You hear them live and talking about they're frightened to death because they hear the sounds of bullets, and they're sitting alone in their safe rooms. And at any given moment, these safe rooms can be penetrated. And you all know what will happen instantaneously after that. And you're hearing this live on television. And I'm listening to this. I'm saying, where are we? Is this the Shoah? Is this the Holocaust? Are we back in Europe, pre-state? But this is broadcast live. I'm sitting in my bed watching television. I take the covers and I literally cover my face, cover my head. And I'm shouting. I'm saying, is this the Holocaust? And so horror, disbelief was certainly the initial reaction. And I watched the news constantly. And Israeli broadcasters are saying from then and certainly for the first week, disbelief, it could not be. It's incomprehensible that something like this could happen. So the first reaction is you're pinching yourself. This can't be. But then, you know, mixed in with this is anger at these behemoths who are ruthless. I can't even think of words to capture Nazi-like behavior. And then there's this sadness and the grief of the lost ones, and the numbers keep mounting over the days. And unfortunately, even today, none of the numbers are final. And but I guess most importantly is determination to move on and to destroy, wipe this enemy off the face of the earth. And I could tell you, and this is really important, and I'm sure you're reading about this, hearing about this, or many of you are involved in helping, in extending your hand to Israel at this time. And there is an unbelievable sense among everyone that this is a battle for our existence and survival. And we are all joining forces together and absolutely determined, A, to wipe this enemy off the face of the earth, and even the communities, the people who are living in these towns and kibbutzim that were really the ones who were rampaged and are utter left in utter devastation and destruction. Many of them are saying, we're going back. We're going to go back at some point when we know that Hamas is finished, because this is our land. We have no other. And that's what Zionism is, be commitment despite the circumstances. And so you have this kind of mixture of emotions that we're all experiencing at this time. And it's interesting to think about Noah. You have to think about Noah, right? Think about Noah, who didn't just watch a few communities being destroyed and people, you know, in immediate surroundings or whatever it is, 1,400, 1,500 people murdered. He's watching the destruction. He had to observe the entire time, the entire world being destroyed. Literally, there's no one on the planet that remains by the time the flood is over other than Noah and his immediate family. And of course, the animals, we're talking about human survival. And you have to imagine for a second what was going through his head. And we often gloss over that. We often like think, okay, well, now we have Noah And then God has the rainbow, and then we end, and we move on, and everything is fine, everything is nice. But let's stop for a moment and think about a psychological well-being or state of affairs. And we have to wonder, what kind of cocktail of emotions was he experiencing after the flood is over? It's very nice that he survived. But how often do we pause and ask ourselves, what is it like to go out and see, you know, after the flood subsides, corpses all over the place, the entire world devastation, nothing left, nothing left. And you're asked to rebuild it, to start from scratch. Now, that can't be an easy proposition. That has to be something that is overwhelming, daunting. And I would imagine many of us wouldn't have the wherewithal to live up to that task. And so it's against that background that we have to begin to analyze, to understand these couple of literally very short texts that we have here, and try to sort of read into it. What the text doesn't give you a lot, but the little that it does give, I think, is worthy of analysis, because I think it gives us, helps shed light on, a little bit on Noah's psychological state of mind. Okay, so let's talk first. The first thing that we hear is, "Vayachad Noach ish ha'adama vayitakave." So, tells us he's a tiller of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. Let's talk about tiller of the soil. What do we make of that? Is that something good or bad? Being a tiller of the soil, oved adama. Well, it seems to me, if you read the text, that you should know. And for those who are not familiar, there are two accounts of the creation. If for those who are hearing this for the first time, if you read the text carefully, you see that the first chapter of Genesis and the second chapter tell completely different stories, and they have different conceptions of God, different conceptions of the human being, different conceptions of the relationship between God and human being, different conceptions of the relationship between man and woman, and a whole range of other things, which I discuss at length in my book. And one of those things is, what is the human being expected to do with his life? What is the task of the human being in this world? Well, according to Genesis chapter 1, right, it's about, I'm just going to, if you want to follow, I'm not going to read it in depth, but it's peru uvu umiru ta'aretz. Our job is to be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it, rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the living things that creep on the earth. That's chapter 1 of Genesis and verse 28. That's the task that we were assigned according to Genesis chapter 1, which is to procreate, fill the earth, etc., and rule, domination, conquest, filling the earth, and sort of using our God-given gift of being the image of God to spread human beings and sort of human dominance throughout the world. But chapter 2 has a very different vision of what a human being is expected to do in this world. And if you look in chapter 2 of Genesis, and you might want to follow with me briefly, what does it say in chapter 2, verse 5? Just read it together, and you'll see how it's relevant to our conversation here. V'chol tziach ha'sadeh terem yeh v'aretz, when no shrub of the field was yet on earth, v'chol esef ha'sadeh terem yitzmach, and no grasses of the field he yet sprouted. Nothing, in other words, there's nothing growing on planet earth, but a flow, because the Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to till the soil. In other words, the Torah is describing a situation in which there is nothing going on. Nothing can grow for two reasons, because there's no rain to water the plants, and there's no human being to cultivate it. What does that suggest about the function of the human being? It says nothing could grow because there was no rain, and there was no human being to cultivate it, right? And the Hebrew is la'avod et ha'adama. So it implies, more than implies, it almost explicit, that the function, the purpose, why did God create human beings? La'avod et ha'adama, to work the land. And after the Adam and Eve are expelled from, banished from Garden of Eden, at the end of chapter 3, if you want to follow chapter 3, it says, chapter 3, verse 23, this is afterwards. I won't discuss the Garden of Eden story. That's a story in of itself with a lot to be said on it. But in chapter 3, verse 23, it says, Vayishalcheo, so afterwards, Vayishalcheo Adonai Elohim Gan Eden le'avod et ha'adama asher lukach misha. So the Lord God banished him from the Garden of Eden to till the soil from which he was taken. So what is the human being expected to do on earth? He's expected to till the soil. La'avod et ha'adama to till the soil. That is his function. That is his duty on this planet, right? It's establish a relationship. By the way, Adam, right? Let's think about, listen to the word. Adam derives from the word Adama. Adama, Adam, Adam, human being. Adama means earth, ground, soil. So we are creatures of the soil, and we are meant largely to work the soil. And having said all that, when we hear that Noah has an Ish Adama, back going back to where we were in chapter nine, which we're reading, the end of chapter nine, the Torah tells us that Ish Adama, okay? And what does he do? Here, in other words, the very fact that it's Ish Adama is certainly sort of praiseworthy. Noah was a person who fulfilled his duty, and it's referring to the way he was perhaps before the flood. In other words, he didn't learn the profession or now after the flood. He was an Ish Adama. That's what he said. Noah was he was a tiller of the soil before the flood. And what does he do after the flood? He continues this occupation. He goes back to it. Now, if that's the case, then I think this is very praiseworthy. Noah, the Ish Adama, he goes back after a complete devastation. The world has an utter ruin. There's nothing left. And what does he do? He says, goes back right to begin his work, to start all over again. He resumes an occupation. He doesn't let the devastation overwhelm him, right? Apparently, for the moment. And he resumes his occupation as an Ish Adama. Great stuff. So we're proud of him, but he goes further. He goes further than just resuming his earlier profession. He was the first to plant a vineyard. Now, there's no description of vineyards before the flood. This is the first time we're hearing of a vineyard ever being planted. Now, what does that say about Noah? There's plenty of it. I would suggest that perhaps it's just a very, again, this is even more impressive, because it's one thing to start from scratch, resume your previous profession. That would be that the amount of internal fortitude, the strength that you need to start all over again after the world has been completely destroyed. That'd be one thing. But to go further, what does he do? He doesn't just resume, right, the task of Oved Adama. He then goes and he plants a vineyard. In other words, he's even going beyond. If you read the text after the Adam and Eve are banished from the Garden of Eden, what does it say? It says, if you recall, and again, we're not going to read it now, but if you recall, after Adam and Eve are banished, the punishment is that it's going to be very difficult to wrest sustenance from the earth, right? If you recall, it said one of the punishment is that bezeata pecha tochalam lechem, right? The best you're going to be able to expect from the earth is bread. You're not going to be, you know, the earth, the relationship between Adam and Adama was harmed by the sin of Adam and Eve. And so one of the punishments, or the punishment of the man, is that his interaction with the ground will be made more difficult and more challenging. And so the land will yield its fruit with much effort. So you'll be able to get your bread, but now Noah, after the flood, rather than surrendering to what could have been an overwhelming task and, you know, throwing up his hands in despair, he goes, not only resumes his task of being tilling the ground, he then goes ahead and plants a vineyard. Wow. The great vines of grapes from which we produce wine. Now, we all know that wine is one of the greatest, you know, for most of us, this is one of the greatest achievements of human being, and to be able to pull from the ground to produce a grape vine from which we can produce wine. As the psalmist says, Yain yisamach levavanosh, right? Yain gladdens the heart. So this is amazing. Noah seems to be determined not just to restore the world to its previous state of affairs, but he seems to be determined to actually upgrade life after the flood. So not only is he working the ground, perhaps bringing bread, because after the flood, you would hope if we could just get bread, we'd be satisfied. No, he's not satisfied. He wants to bring wine, perhaps joy from the earth. Now, that would also make a lot of sense, because What we need at a time like this, when we're starting all over again, we need some joy. And so he creates, or he plants this vineyard, and then in the hope that perhaps their life would be filled with joy once again. How wonderful! If I have to look and assess Noah's behavior at this stage, I would say, really a great man. Great man who was not willing to surrender to despair and depression. He found a way to forge ahead, start all over, and even beyond what existed before. But then something happens. And this is not, none of this is explicit in the text, but to me it begs interpretation. What happened? So I'd like to propose that this is not something that happened overnight. We'll talk about it in a moment. While his intentions may have been very good, like I said, he wants wine, which allows and brings forth joy into the world. But there's another side to wine, as we all know. And so I'd like to suggest that while he emerged from the ark, determined to move forward, to start all over with a lot of energy, over time, I'm suggesting, start to sink in. You know, sometimes, you know, instinctive reaction to grief is action, is just doing, is moving forward. And at some point, it hits you. I'd like to suggest, you know, you think about what's going through Noah's head. I'm alone here. Yes, I have my wife and my children. That's it. There's nothing else in the world right now. You think about his memories as he's tilling the soil, as he's dealing with his grapevines, and he's determined to rebuild the world. But at some point, sinks in. I've got no one here to work with. No one to hug me, to hold me, to support me. They're all gone. And at some point, your resolve to continue to forge ahead when you're alone, when you see utter devastation, it hits you like a ton of bricks. I can't. This is just too much. And to make matters worse, and this is a reading of the beginning of Sefer Bereshit that requires care to see this, that you probably know that God promised, right, after the flood, he promised that he won't inflict another flood again. And what is the great sign? Is the rainbow. And so we have this image where he sees this rainbow, he emerges from the flood, and it's so cheerful and soothing and peaceful. And you think that he goes ahead and, oh. But that's only one version of the story. Because in my reading, the same way there are two accounts of creation. There are two accounts of the flood. And the response or the aftermath of the flood is described in two different accounts. So I'd like to take a look for a second. Go back to the end of chapter 8. At the end of chapter 8, verse 20. So at the end of chapter 8, this is one version of the story of the flood. What does Noah do? Vayivin Noach mizbeach la'Hashem la'Adonai. Noach built an altar to the Lord. Vayikach mikol ha'beimah ha'teorah u'mikol ha'of ha'tohor. This is chapter 8, verse 20. And mikol ha'of ha'tohor vayal olot b'mizbeach. Taking of every clean animal and every clean bird, he offered burnt offerings on the Lord. Now, presumably he did this as a way of appeasing God, hoping that God will accept this and forgive or be softened, and hopefully this will make God more compassionate and forgiving. And in fact, what does it say in the next text, the next verse? Vayarech rach Adonai et reach hanichoach, vayomar Adonai el libo, lo'osif lekalel od et ha'adama ba'avur ha'adam, ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra mine'urav, ve'lo'osif od lehakot et kol chai asher asiti, kasher asim. The Lord smelled the pleasing odor, and the Lord said to himself, never again will I doom the earth because of man, since the devisings of man's mind are evil from his youth, nor will I ever again destroy every living being as I have done. Now, you would imagine that Noah, hearing this, would be relieved. He brought this offering after the flood. And God accepted it. And God made this dramatic promise that this will never happen again. And so that should have given Noah the encouragement, the internal strength to move ahead, because God promised never to do this again. There's only one little problem, and people don't notice this because they don't read the text carefully. Did God share this information with Noah? I see that Ruth is shaking her head. I'm going to read it again and emphasize two words. The Lord smelled a pleasing odor, and the Lord said to himself, never again will I doom the earth because of man. God, in this account, never shares the promise with Noah. And so Noah must be left wondering, did God accept my offering or not? I have no idea. I have no idea. God promised that he will never bring a flood again. I don't know that. He spoke to himself. He never shared that with me. Now, how does this impact his psyche? If Noah is going out to the world and starting all over, but he never heard this promise, then what's to stop him from thinking that another flood is right around the corner? Why invest the time and energy to rebuild the world from nothing when I have no reason to believe that tomorrow or the next day there won't be another flood? And so now I'm beginning to understand a little bit about Noah's right thought process or emotional condition after the flood. See, at some point, I'd like to suggest that if Noah originally planted a vineyard in the hope of gladdening the heart, of bringing joy into a joyless world, at some point, he discovered something else about the vine, the grapevine, that it produces wine that if you drink in excess, it allows you to sort of dull your senses, allows you to escape from the challenges of life. As we all know, what happens to people who become drunk? It's a release. It's sort of entering another kind of state of mind where you're not aware of what's going on, where people who have challenges, right? I'm not talking about, you know, people who drink and occasionally get drunk, right? This is, it may be a one-time affair, but I would imagine he'd been getting into the habit. He became an alcoholic to some extent because that was his way of coping with the reality that he was facing, right? Having seen destruction of everything around him and everyone he ever knew, and having no knowledge of the fact that God made some kind of promise that this will never happen again. Some point it sunk in and he realized that maybe there's a way to deal with this by escaping it, by drinking yourself silly until you're not aware of what's happening. What I'm trying to suggest is that we have two stages in Noah's behavior after the flood. The first one was very positive and very encouraging, right? He comes out of the ark and he determined to move ahead, and he starts to plant and start all over again. He plants a vineyard. But at some point, I'm suggesting, you know, reality set in, and this great grapevine, right, became a vehicle for escaping reality rather than confronting it, rather than building the world. And so the text tells us that he drank, he became drunk, he uncovered himself, or in his drunkenness, he lost sense of propriety and of modesty, and he was undressed, he was naked. And then his son saw him, and all the negative things that happen as a result. I believe that there is something deeply troubling about this that reflects a state of mind or a state of affairs in the psyche of Noah that it could be understood, right, if we think about it. And so here we have, I believe, right, an insight, a glimpse into Noah's state of mind after the flood. And going back to Israel, you know, it's the question that begs itself at this stage is, everyone today is determined to move ahead. This country is now, and again, I would say the Jewish people around the world are united in this commitment to eradicating this terror group and doing whatever we need to do to help rebuild this country after the worst devastation in its history. And there's no hesitation. Everyone is opening their pockets and opening their hearts and opening their homes. And, you know, the WhatsApp groups in terms of what we can do to help our brother in food. I mean, my wife spends the entire day in the kitchen and in the local matnas, which is sort of like a community center. And they have Chayalim here. The soldiers are coming and she's overseeing the food. And just, everyone is busy doing something. And if you're not busy, you're constantly asking, what can I do? What can I do? There's a sense of solidarity and commitment and determination to move forward. The question as a society, which needs to be asked, is how long will that last? And obviously we hope it will last, but the question that begs itself is okay, when this is all over, hopefully quickly, and hopefully ends in a complete victory for the Israeli Defense Forces, we all hope and pray that we will succeed. But what happens the day after? Will we continue? Will we be able to rebuild our lives? All the bickering and internal tension that happened before the outbreak of this war, right? Will we go back to the infighting and the tension and the, you know, divisions within Israeli society? Will the families that have been broken, the families who have been broken, I can't even imagine what kind of effort it will require for them to start all over. It's unspeakable, right? And everyone now is in it. I'm not talking about the soldiers captive, but even in the families who have known lost ones, and even they are talking, we have to go on. Life has to go on, because that's the way Israel is. That's the way we are as a people. You know, we bury our dead and we move forward. But at some point, you know, not everyone has the internal strength to move forward in that way. And so what do we learn from Noah? I said, we learn that Noah, you know, really was driven, determined after the flood to move forward, to start all over and even beyond. But again, according to this reading, Noah at some point sort of lost it. He lost his ability and depression sunk in. And then he couldn't sustain all the determination he had at the very beginning. And that's a question I think we all have to ask ourselves today. Can we? I mean, that's the challenge. The challenge is sustaining this wonderful goodwill that we've seen surface over the last 2 weeks. Amazing goodwill. And the question is, when the dust settles and Hamas is defeated, you know, are we going to be changed for the better? Are we going to be determined to move forward the way we have been since then? And that's the question that Noah leaves us, you know, asking. Right? Are we going to be the Noah type who we start off determined, and then eventually when things really hit home, are we going to lose it and lose our focus and, well, get drunk metaphorically in sinking in depression? And we can't allow ourselves that, but I think that's a lesson of Noah. Now, I could end the class right now. I could end the class right now because I think it's a wonderful message, but it's only 45 minutes as I anticipated. And I actually want to suggest another reading of this story, another reading of this story. Whereas again, just to remind you again, I'm reading this drunkenness in a particular way as kind of escapism. His drunkenness is an attempt to escape from the tsaros of that he's facing right after the flood and even after the original initial kind of response. And in a sense, my reading thus far is about not a calculated response. It's sort of, he sunk into it when things, and he fell into this and discovered the intoxicating effects of wine. And then he, well, fell into this drunkenness as many alcoholics do. And for them, you know, it's usually people who have a lot of sorrows in life and don't know how to confront them who fall into this very pattern of, you know, drinking and drunkenness. And I'm suggesting that with Noah as well. But I want to offer a different reading of the story. And in order to do so, you're going to have to, you know, have your antennas up. And I'm going to give you little hints to where I'm going with this, and maybe you'll pick up on it. And here I would love for, when I start saying this, I would love for someone to, you know, press your button and speak up to see if you're getting where I'm going with this. So here we go. I'm going to throw out a few key words that appear to the story that we just read and see if it rings a bell. Oh, are you ready with your biblical text, with your Tanakh, with your Chumash? So here we go. The text tells us that Noach, we're back to our story in chapter 9, verse 20. So what does it say? Noach planted. He planted. He planted a vineyard. Okay. Focus on the word planted. He drank, which sort of impaired his ability to think clearly. He lost his senses. Okay. That led him to inappropriately uncover himself. And he lay there naked. That's what the text says, right? The text says in verse 22, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness. So in his state of drunkenness, where he's really doesn't know what's going on, he's unaware, and his son, right, his son Ham, right, sees him naked. So he's uncovered and he's naked. Then Shem and Yafet covered him. And after he woke up, he learned, and the Hebrew word for learned is Vayeda. Vayeda, the Hebrew means he knew. But JBS translated as he learned, it could easily be translated as, and he knew, or he became aware what happened, what his youngest son had done to him. Okay. Did anybody pick up any associations? And if you did, just like speak up.
It's the Gan story redux.
The Garden of Eden. Listen carefully. Yeah. Thank you, Ruth. Listen carefully. Okay? Go back to chapter 2 of Genesis. Go back to chapter 2. Keep your finger on chapter 9, but keep your finger on chapter 2 of Genesis.
Why okay? Don't you read it in Hebrew?
I'm sorry?
I'll read it in Hebrew. It will be easier to spot it.
I will read the Hebrew and in English. Okay? Chapter 2, Perek Bet. Okay? Pasuk Chet. Chapter 2, verse 8 of Genesis. Vayita Hashem Elokim Gan De'Eden. God planted a garden in Eden. Right? What does it say about Noach? Vayita Karim. He planted a vineyard. Oh, let's move on. What was the state of mind? What was their situation? What did they not possess in the Garden of Eden until they sinned? They didn't have their knowledge was limited because God prohibited them from eating from Eitz Hadaat Tovara. So they had a limited amount of knowledge. Some would argue, and I would argue, they had kind of naive, kind of childlike knowledge of the world, but not the sophisticated knowledge of an adult. So their knowledge was limited. Wait. And as a result, when they were walking around the garden, what was their state, their physical state? Well, it says very clearly, if you look at, you know, the end of chapter 2, Perek Bet, Pasuk Kafe, the end of Perek Bet, the last Pasuk, the last verse of chapter 2, Vayushnehem Agumin Ha'adam V'ishto, the two of them were naked, the man and his wife. Yet they felt no shame. So in the state of unknowing, of limited knowledge, they're naked, not aware. And what happens when they eat from Eitz Hadaat? They eat from the tree of knowledge. What then happens? They realize they're naked. That's the first thing that happens. In chapter 3, Perek Gimel, okay? Pasuk Zayin, chapter 3, verse 7. Vatipakachna einei shneihem vayedu keilu mimhem. The eyes of both of them that were open, they perceived that they were naked. They knew. Vayedu, that's the Hebrew word. They knew that they were naked. Okay? And then they cover themselves. Okay? And God, at the end of chapter 3, Pasuk Kaf Aleph 3:21, Gimel Kaf Aleph, Vayas Hashem Elokim Adam Ishto Kotnot O Vayal Bishem. And the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. So once They became aware of their state, physical state, their nakedness. First of all, they're suddenly aware and they're embarrassed because now they know, and then God covers them. Guys, the parallels are striking. Striking! Noah planted, God planted. Okay, Noah drank, which led to his sort of loss of cognition, of awareness. Right? Adam and Eve lacked awareness. When he became drunk and then he turned naked. And when he woke up from his nakedness, he became sober again. Then he realized he was naked. Okay. And Vayeda, and he learned what his son had done to him. His brothers covered him. The parallels are striking. Okay. Now the question is, what is the text trying to tell us? So here's my suggestion. Okay. I'm going to read from my book here, and this is a conclusion I drew, and I'm really going to read. In planting a vineyard on the soil and getting drunk from it, Noah did not merely attempt to reestablish a relationship with the ground after it had been cursed since the time of Adam and Eve, but he sought to recreate an alternative post-diluvian Garden of Eden, post-diluvian, post-flood Garden of Eden. In other words, his goal was not just mere escapism. It wasn't just, I don't know what to do with myself, I'm going to drink. What I'm suggesting now is that a very clearly calculated plan. How am I going to cope with the reality? Well, I'm going to create this paradise that we once had in our past. I am now going to recreate or try to recreate a Gan Eden. By drinking, I'm going to recreate the unknowing kind of existence, right? And return, so to speak. How do I cope? I don't cope by mere escapism. I cope by escaping to something familiar, something that is like where life is perfect, where there are no problems, where everything is wonderful. Because if we go from one extreme, what's the solution to the utter devastation, right? Is to go to the other extreme where everything was perfect, in the paradise that got ended. So do I recreate that? And so if my reading is correct here, then that in fact was Noah's creating an alternative universe, not by literally sink into a depression where he doesn't know what to do. According to this reading, Noah knew exactly what he was doing. He was trying to recreate Gan Eden and to create, right, an alternative, right, where everything is perfect, just as it was in Gan Eden. But the fact that things didn't quite work out the way that he anticipated, and this was perhaps God's way of telling him that neither he nor his descendants should look backward, but rather forward, that the wonderful world of the Garden of Eden should remain a thing of the past, a lost paradise that would forever live on in their hearts and minds, but not as something to be revisited or recreated now or at any time in the foreseeable future. So, according to this reading, the problem was Noah's failure to understand that the world after the flood was not meant to be a recreation of the world as it was prior to the flood. His task now was to confront the challenges ahead and not to avoid them by reverting to the comfortable life of the past. Although Noah might have succeeded in his efforts had he simply raised his children and worked as a tiller of the soil without planting a vineyard and the negative results that ensued, once he had done so, there was no turning back. What's the message if this is the reading of the story? There are two ways to deal with problems. You can ignore them. You can sink into a depression and escape them by not facing them. Or you can go and imagine an alternative universe where everything is perfect from one extreme to the other. And imagine that unless we solve the problems, unless we recreate a paradise, a perfect life, nothing's good enough. There's polar opposites, but neither one, in my opinion, is an adequate solution to death and destruction, to challenges in life in general. I think that what we need to do is not ignore our problems, not drink our way our sorrows, and not to imagine that the solution is, you know, some kind of imaginary paradise, a perfect world where there are no problems anymore. I think the challenge that the text leaves us with, again, depending how you read the story, is to face reality, to understand the challenges ahead, and to be realistic and understand the world is imperfect. Life is imperfect. Relationships are imperfect. Things are complex. And we need to find the strength to face the challenges, knowing there are not going to be perfect solutions, and to persevere nonetheless. I would say that about life in general, and I would say that specifically about Israel. And our expectations from all of this is, even once we defeat Hamas, we're not going to have world peace. Unless you're naive. We're still going to have countless challenges ahead. The question is, are we willing to face them honestly and use the wonderful goodwill and the good spirit that we've seen exhibited over the last couple of weeks continue? Are we going to be willing to fight to keep us together, to keep ourselves together, which it was not the case for the 9 months prior to this horrible, horrible attack? But we have to be grounded and realistic, right? It's not going to be, we're going to turn Israel into a paradise. We're going to do, right? We're going to take, right, what we have, and we're going to make it the best that we can, knowing that at the end of the day, it's not going to be perfect, like life isn't perfect. And so I believe here that Noah left us with a dramatic, very powerful message, not necessarily because Noah was the sort of ideal candidate or was a perfect model for this, but even in Noah's failure, again, I'm reading this as a failure at the end of the day, that he left us an important message about how we confront challenges of life today, tomorrow, and the next day. So I'm finished. And if you have any questions, I understand this is the time. So feel free to ask.
If you want, hold on. Just before you ask, there are a few questions in the chat box. You want to take a look.
Okay. I haven't done Zoom in quite a while. You're going to have to be patient with me.
I mean, otherwise I can read you the comments, but in the meantime.
Yeah, yeah. Where are they? Chat box. I'm looking for it. Chat. Oh, I see. 19 comments. Okay, one sec. How do I? Oh, I see. Okay. Question. Again, but averted lesson. I'm sorry. Could there also be a connection with the story of Lot? Yes. There could be a connection with Lot. It's wonderful comment, whoever said this. Yes. You're talking about the daughters of Lot in the sense they, right, he got drunk. There is a connection, although, the answer is yes. It's worthy of examination, and it's an excellent question. Okay. I don't want to go through all of it and keep you waiting. Maybe if there's a question that I could address, these are wonderful comments I see, and I'm going through this. Is and he uncovered himself the correct position of Yidgal instead of and he became uncovered? One second. I'm going to look at the JPS. Hold on one second. Wait a second. The translation, he uncovered himself. I don't know. I'm reading the JPS translation. If I had time, I could pull out some of my other translations, but I am relying on the JPS, which I think is quite good. Typically, I don't agree with everything they say. So, I'm going to accept this translation, at face value. Lot's drunkenness, father's drunkenness. Yes. Okay. Another parallel between the flood and Sodom stories. All right, whoever's made that comment is very astute. Where did Noah get the grapevines, etc.? Okay, well, good question. These are some of the questions that the text doesn't address. There's like a lacuna in the text about practical stuff, right? You know, where did he get grapes from? Good question. I don't have an answer. The text doesn't answer, and so I'm going to leave it unanswered. Perhaps is giving up. He wants to draw in his grief and despair and alcohol stupor. Oh, whoever said that, that's what I said. Okay. But God tells Noah in the chapter that he won, won't destroy flesh. I explained that he didn't tell him. He didn't share that with him. Perhaps Noah got drunk even if he did know that God promised never again. Right. You're right. Even if God had promised, he might still get. But I would say all the more so if he wasn't even aware of God's promise, he's more likely to get drunk. Guys, your comments are amazing. Yes. Yes. The Akamuti Briti is the other version of the flood. It's not, again, you have to read my book to understand. There are two versions of the flood story, and the Hakibuti Briti is a promise that God makes according to the other version of the flood, not the one that I'm reading. Wine, alcohol might act as a bomb as somebody who's working as a chip. Then zookeeper, physical wounds. Wow. You guys are great. It sounds like the opposite of Adam from eating the tree. Oh, very nice. Somebody's anticipated that. At four, okay. Okay, could it be okay? Most of these are, why did he curse his grandson? Okay, that's a question I don't want to address. I said that's one of the questions that typically I talk about it in my book. Anyway, any other questions you'd like to ask besides those that are on the chat box?
Right.
Feel free. So,
question. Well, it's not a question. It's just an observation or a question. So you're seeing like a Rav Breuer that there's the Yudkei Vavkei versus Elohim story here.
Both.
Right.
My entire book, it's called, Discovering the Two Worldviews. It's called In the Beginnings, Discovering the Two Worldviews Hidden Within Genesis 1 through 11. And right. I present the biblical criticism. I present P and J, and I present P and J as either biblical sources, as for those who are unfamiliar, the documentary hypothesis claims that there are two sources, two authors, but Mordechai Breuer claims that God speaks in multiple voices. And right. So I present both side by side.
So now I see Yudkei Vavkei speaks to his heart.
Yes.
Tells himself one thing, but yes. Then Elohim speaks to Noach and talks about a brit, and perhaps they're not talking, past each other.
Completely different versions, but it's not just a response. The entire flood story, they're intertwined, but if you need to understand that they're intertwined, but if you work the Sherlock Holmes style, you can see that there are two parallel stories, which okay. I have three full chapters on this. So, the book is available on Amazon. If you're interested, I would certainly be delighted if you decided to read my book. But this is just a snippet of what I talk about. This is mostly a good chunk of chapter 9, which I discuss here, but right. 9 of my book. Right. Anyway.
So the other thing to note, so when Noah is trying to, it's a description of a recreation of the Gan, but the big problem is, or not the problem, but the major difference is God planted his Gan.
Yes.
And Noah now is trying to recreate that, but he'll never get there. And his Kerem is like a failed Gan. He, instead of having big, beautiful trees, he has these stunted vines. So that's really, that should clue you in that it's not going to work.
Okay. Well, he was willing to give it a try, and it didn't work. But yes, I'm trying to enter his mindset, thinking, he had a notion that he can sort of do what God did.
Yeah.
Listen, God saved him, right? So he's a pretty special kind of guy. Maybe he thought at some point he might be God. By the way, okay, I don't want to go into too much to say, but wonderful comments, Ruth. I appreciate it. Any other questions? This is the time.
I didn't really have a question, but when you're describing that it can either be this extreme or this extreme.
Right.
I think when you go through a real tragedy, first you're sort of numb.
Yes.
And then later on you relate to it. Then you might want to numb yourself, and then you can go on to work in other words, there are stages to it that take a little from each of those extremes and combine them. And I think that's really much more realistic. I don't think any person right away says, we'll do this. We'll go on, we'll rebuild. They first have to, get centered again is the phrase I use.
Debbie, I want to tell you about the last 2 weeks in Israel. I'm telling you, it took 24 hours, maybe, before people, and I speak about myself, 24 hours just being utter shock, devastation, paralysis. For 24 hours. I'm telling you, the next day, maybe 2 days, the entire country is out. What can we do? What can we do? In other words, there was not a moment that's, I'm not talking about, the families who were the victims of the 14. I know people, but, I, like most Israelis, not the ones who were immediately affected because they had loved ones or have loved ones. I can't believe that I'm still saying this present tense, right? That there are still hundreds of people captive. It's indescribable. I can't even imagine functioning. But the rest of Israeli society, and I speak about myself and everyone around me in Efrat, okay? And everywhere, everyone within a day or two, we are completely like get our heads on straight, and we are all working round the clock. What can we do every moment? What can we do to help? What can we give?
It's compared to yeshiva and shloshim.
Oh, so you want to, yeah. So one could say that, and I don't know. I don't know if I know your the analogy here. I'm not sure. I just don't. I think the devastation is so much.
Or maybe it's changed. Go from Onen to Shiva to Shloshim.
I understand this, the psychological. Listen, I'm not a psychologist.
No,
I understand the different stages of grief, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, having set Shiva for loved ones, family members. But I'm just observing around me, and I can tell you right now, no one's sitting depressed other than I should say no one. I'm saying the vast majority, the bulk of Israeli society is stepping up in a way that's sort of unimaginable before this. In other words, if there's a silver lining in this horror, it's what's happening within Israeli society. And the question is, can we sustain that? And that's the question, because I'd like to think so. But I'm realistic enough to know that when this is over, and like I said, when Hamas is wiped off the planet, which I think is what we all hope for, we're going to go back to bickering. And the question is it going to be any better? I'd like to believe it'll be better because we have a little perspective on what's at stake, which we didn't have before this. So I'd like to believe that it'll be better, but I don't imagine a perfect world. We're all going to love each other and like we do now. You know, I don't see it sustaining that because there are real issues in this country, divisive issues. And so again, not being a psychologist, I just see what's going on around me and I have questions. I'm thrilled with the reaction of the people now, to what's going on. And we've never been more together than we have been the last 2 weeks, working in unison, working this really brotherhood and love and camaraderie and solidarity and all wonderful things that we haven't seen for so long. But, you know, can we sustain it or can we even expect to sustain it in this kind of perfect world image? And I think that that's not what we should look for. We should seek at least learning how to, you know, to improve upon the horrible condition of our internal situation beforehand from what was as a result of this war. Any other questions or thoughts before Jay decides to terminate this session? That's
I don't. I let people talk as long as they're willing to talk.
Oh, I'm here. I'm here. Listen, I'm already up, guys. It's 3:30. It's now 4:38 in the morning for me. I'm wide awake. The chances of my falling back to sleep at the stage are nil, and I have to keep myself busy. So, if you want to ask me questions, for those who are still on.
Thank you. Amazing class.
You guys are great. Really, my first time at Torah in Motion, and I had no idea what to expect. Jay didn't tell me about how really intelligent and learned you guys are. And
it's in the guidelines a little bit. We have an intelligent, sophisticated nuance.
So
you have to experience it. No, Baruch Hashem. Anyways, really, I do want to thank you for a very, very powerful sharing, of course. It's hard. You know, those of us, and I guess this is almost all of us, I see David Eisen's here in Beit Shemesh, but all of us who live in Chutz Laaretz, it's whatever. I mean, it's a whole different thing. You know, you guys are defending us and all the hatreds. They had a rally in Toronto, you know, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free and chop and kill the Jews, whatever they're saying all over. It just shows you how Israel is the protection for Jews around the world. So, without, you know, God forbid, we know what it was like before Israel. In Israel, people don't always realize that we can walk around as proud Jews in North America because of you guys in Israel who are defending us and doing all the hard work, and we sort of benefit. So we should hear good news, and your son and everybody should be safe and well. And
amen.
So what else can I say? And, please God, next week we'll have two more Israeli, you know, speakers beginning series. Rabbi Liebtag will, of course, he's been, you know, with all the Sundays, Yontif, and we didn't start last week, but he'll be restarting his series on the Birmi Shonim on Shmuel on Sunday morning, 11:15. And Rabbi Shlomo Brody will be starting a 4-part series on medical ethical issues. You know, the head of Amatai used to be known as HODS, a Halachic Organ Donor Society, but now they're known as Amatai. And he'll be talking about this week, should we pray for terminally ill people to die, end of life, sort of ethical issues in halakha. And Nadi Helfgott, who of course is rabbi in Teaneck, where I think you were supposed to be.
I was supposed to be there, Parshat Noach.
You're supposed to be in his shul for Shabbos. So Rabbi Helfgott will be beginning a year-long series on the Lakim Beit. did last year, sort of a year-long series, Amalek and Melech. That'll be Wednesday night. So those are our three new series beginning next week. Of course, I'll have, he's got my shear on the sitter tomorrow morning at 9:15. And all our regular classes, though, next week, of those who are there, Julie Mishkin will not be teaching this particular week. She's going to make it this week back. Please God, a week from Wednesday. So anyways, we look forward to hearing good news, to learning with you and your friends, and we should come together, and the scoot of Limud Torah should act to protect the Jewish people in Israel and around the world. And thank you, Rabbi, and I apologize that you didn't get so much sleep because of the shear, but okay.
It was worth it.
We enjoyed it, so I'm glad if you enjoyed it too and found it worth it. So
we'll especially enjoy our Shabbos wine.
Very good.
Yes. And as David pointed out, you know, I don't think you mentioned that, of course, if you hold that in Gan Eden, the forbidden fruit was wine, it adds even a more power to the story. You know, you in the Midrash. So thank you for that. Okay, everybody. Laila Tov. We hope to see you. Learning. Okay.
Yeah. Erev Tov and Laila Tov.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
So
okay.
Thank you.
Amen.
Amen.